By electing John and the Reverend, you can make an immediate difference in your own lives, the lives of the people all across this country, because their election will put an end to the block in Washington, that $2,000 stimulus check, that money that will go out the door immediately. Tell people who are in real trouble.
And the people said, fuck yeah, we'll elect John and the Reverend if we're going to get $2,000 immediately.
Well, I propose that we, because it was bipartisan, I thought it would increase the prospects of passage, the additional $1,400 in direct cash payment to folks. Well, there's legitimate reason for people to say, do you have the lines drawn the exact right way? Should it go to anybody making over X number of dollars or Y? I'm open to negotiate those things.
So $2,000 has become $1,400, but at least it's immediate.
So he thinks by March it could get passed?
Well, I don't want to give a deadline on it, Caitlin, but I think we are all mindful and looking at that timeline in March as to when we will hit the unemployment cliff. And it's vital to get things done quickly and rapidly, as quickly as possible.
So immediate really means quickly and rapidly and quickly as possible. You see, when Joe Biden said $2,000 immediately, he was telling the truth at the time. These things happen when King Donald said he was going to build a big beautiful wall and Mexico would pay for it. He was certain that that would happen when he said it. Doesn't matter which political party you're with, which government you're with, which country you're in. There is no such thing as a lie for a politician. But for us, it's about Gloriana, baby Betty. Let's get on with it.
Your breath is sweet, with your eyes I like two jewels in the sky. Your back is straight, your hair is smooth on the pillow where you lie. But I don't sense affection, no gratitude or love. Your loyalty is not to me, but to the stars above.
Yeah, 1975, and Bob Dylan there, looking for one more cup of coffee from his album Desire. Marvellous stuff. Last week was all about Mary dying after fucking up a fair bit. Remember Jane Dormer? Do you remember that one? She was Kitty King Ted's girlfriend. She then went on to be Mary's BFF. She tells us that Mary, being at the last point and sick to death nonetheless, asked that Mass be said in the chamber before dawn on the morning of November 17th. Despite her extremity, she heard it with so good attention, zeal and devotion, as she answered every part with him that served the priest. Yeah, I think that's the problem right there. Full on for magical bullshit for Mary. Now let's have that corpse mature for about 3 weeks while we all make new funeral frocks. December 1558, and the corpse can have a nice little trip from St. James Palace to Westminster. Usual stuff, hundreds in the procession, thousands in the crowds. Chief mourner will be her cousin Margaret Douglas, Countess of Lennox. We'll get dead Mary into Westminster, then 100 guys in black can keep vigil overnight. Next day, Bishop of Winchester, John White, will give the full bells and whistles requiem mass. That's the Catholic stuff. And that might cost him his job under the new regime. No, it will cost him his job. Yeah, we don't want the Catholic stuff anymore. She was never unmindful or uncareful of her promise to the realm. She used singular mercy towards offenders. She used much pity and compassion towards the poor and oppressed. She used clemency among her nobles. She restored more noble houses decayed than ever did prince of this realm, or I pray God ever shall have the like occasion to do hereafter. Yeah, look, guys like Tom Cramer may disagree with her mercy towards offenders, except he's a pile of ash, so he can't disagree. Off we all go to dinner. Hang on there, you Bishop John White. You can go straight home and into house arrest for such offences as you've committed in your sermon at the funeral of the late Queen. Naughty boy. But for us, there goes our second Queen of England, but the first one to actually rule. Her immediate reputation will be pretty darn bad, as you might expect. But we can discount that stuff if we want on the basis that the Protestants are about to be back in charge. Somewhere in about 100 years, she will cop the title Bloody Mary to help perceptions that she was a bloodthirsty tyrant. And that sticks. Even now, she's known as Bloody Mary. Fair enough. If you burn people, fuck you. Bloody Mary. It won't be until the 20th century that some historians want to try and get her out and polish her up a bit, make her a bit more shiny and a bit more presentable. Who cares? It's your call as usual. For me, Mary kicked off well with a bit of economic reform. I'm always pleased with that. But overall, her management of the economy wasn't very good. She wasn't helped by 2 years of bad weather, but if you've got a strong economy, that can help you mitigate some of the negative impacts. Our Roman big swinging dicks knew that they always, always, always needed the ability to bring in grain to feed the mob in tough times, which ensured their own safety. Mary, though, didn't have the resources, so we got the prayer book rebellion. Again, for me, it's more about the economy and times were shit that tipped the mob. Just as today in the USA, we're having protests. Both sides are protesting. And you can tell me if you like, it's all about politics. But I suggest that if those people were in well-paid jobs, then they wouldn't feel particularly motivated to go out and protest or support Trump. No, they'd be out at the movies or buying a new whatever and too content to get out on the street. And look, I bag our Australian politicians, but they get that. They keep us dumb, fat and happy. We're having same problems as the USA, and the government's pouring out money to all sorts of people as relief and to keep the economy going, while we're all in lockdown, and the government says lockdown here, and we say, yeah, sure, okay, we'll do it, because life's good. Her marriage to Phil was a bit of a dodgy move, and at one point they looked at his family tree to find John of Gaunt and said, hey, Phil's an English gentleman. To which the mob all said, oh, no, he's not. Yeah, you can't tell us he's an English gentleman just because John of Gaunt's in his fucking family tree there somewhere. John of Gaunt's in a lot of people's family tree. We were in uncharted territory as to what a king consort was. No legislation to guide us, but it didn't really matter. You couldn't really do legislation because it's the magic law bullshit. And Tom Cramer, who was pushing for separation of powers, got himself burned. We have no numbers of Mary's religious victims, but it's certainly in the hundreds. For me, they're all unacceptable, but particularly Tom Cramer, who legally should not have been burned. He recanted. That should have got him off. And that just smacks of revenge and nastiness. On the other hand, we do have a concern for common smelly types and a work to help the poor. It's disappointing that Mary didn't take the opportunity to do something towards women's equality, but really that's not going to happen until Nietzsche can burst into life and pronounce that God is dead. Still, at least Mary has shown us that gender doesn't matter when it comes to rulers. Mary was no better or worse than other kings we've had. If you were expecting more from her based on her gender, then sorry, you're probably looking at the wrong thing. Mary ruled a male-dominated society that had to take account of magical bullshit in its decision-making. Pretty challenging in, well, it's a toxic environment, isn't it, really? Humans are complicated, so once again, your call on Mary's performance appraisal. For us, my dear listener, it is time to welcome our Gloriana. I present to you Elizabeth I. Little bit of music got played once before in this podcast series. If you cast your mind back to, I don't know, probably about episode 7, use that when we were talking about Alfred the Great, and I thought it was worth trotting out again for our Gloriana. Our listener Andrew Palmer recently said he was looking forward to getting my take on the rule of Baby Betty, and there you go, Andrew. That's the direction I'm going in at the moment. Baby Betty's already knocked back that marriage proposal from Phil, and a reminder that Mary was still alive and pining for that fucker Phil at the time. Bit rude of him, wasn't it? the ambassador will report back. She must have been thoroughly schooled in the manner in which her father conducted his affairs, and I am very much afraid that she will not be well disposed in matters of religion, for I see her inclined to govern through men who are believed to be heretics, and I am told that the women around her definitely are. She puts great store by the people, and is very confident that they are on her side, which is certainly true, they are. She declares that it was the people who put her in a present position. She is determined to be governed by no one. Yes, I feel that's a no. Maybe Betty's coming in better equipped than Mary, because maybe Betty's been able to observe what went down with the woman ruler. One standout for me was that Mary had a constant battle with the council, those dickhead men. Betty, despite being one of those inferior female types, will have to figure out how to dominate that council. Back when we were looking at Jane Grey as a queen, we had a bright guy right on the subject. A queen was acceptable as a ruler despite her gender, chiefly because she didn't call the shots. So yeah, his take was a woman can rule as long as she gets men to make the decisions for her. Women rulers were weak in nature, feeble in body, soft in courage, unskillful in practice, and not terrible to the enemy. To help us all with this woman, I'll reveal to you one of her best weapons, language. And that is an area where it seems we do have a biological difference, with women better able to employ language, and Betty knows how to do it. She studied rhetorics, that staple of Roman noble families. Any Roman with an ounce of ambition studied rhetoric, but in England, the men still value being able to hit people hard over language. She's also got some men who are on side. Sir Nicholas Throckmorton, friend of the teen King Ted and cousin of Catherine Parr, will tell her, "Beware of womanish levity, for where the king governs not in severity and prudence, there does emulation and ambition sow their seeds." Yeah, you're gotta be a hard woman there, Betty. And absolutely, really, guys like our old Tom Howard or Stephen Gardner-Buhis have got zero humour in their makeup, and don't think we haven't got more of these types hanging around. And we're just going to recap Betty. So 7th of September 1533, and Anne Boleyn has just given us the baby Betty. That will make Betty 25 right now. Let's pop back to a christening for a tick and see who's there. Okay, we've got Tom Cranmer. He'll be the godfather. Of course, he'll be burnt alive. Here comes Henry Borchia, Earl of Essex, carrying the gilt basins. He's a descendant of baby Ted, Edward III, through his youngest lad, and he's the last in line of that particular magnificent branch of the family. His fate will be to fall off his horse and die with no heir, so the Earl of Essex gig will go to Commoner's Mark Tom Cromwell eventually, and the nobles will not be pleased with that, and of course Tom Cromwell will have his head off. Bringing in the salt is Henry, Marquess of Dorset, father of Lady Jane Grey, who, after receiving a pardon, will join the White Rebellion and have his head off, as will Lady Jane Grey. Here comes William Courtney, Marquess of Exeter, and grandson of Edward the IV. He'll be rounded up and executed along with the poles. Oh, here's a girlie, Lady Mary Howard, daughter of Tom Howard, Duke of Norfolk, and she'll turn evidence against her brother Henry Howard, Earl of Surrey, who'll have his head off. And in comes the Dowager Duchess of Norfolk as godmother, whose granddaughter, Catherine Howard, will have her head off. Another godmother coming in is the Marchioness of Exeter, who will see her husband have his head off, her son spend his teen years in the slammer, and then she'll be attainted herself and sent to the slammer. Here's the proud Earl of Wiltshire, Tom Boleyn, who will see his son and daughter have their heads off. Here's Lord Hussey, who will join the bigot rebellion and have his head off. Here's Tom Howard, who will get it on with Margaret Douglas and spend the rest of his life in the slammer. And, oh, look, it's a young Sir John Dudley, whose dad had his head off, and he'll have his head off, and then his son will have his head off. Now, I thought I'd just pop in that little guest list from the christening for anybody who wants to think, gee whiz, wish I'd been a noble back in Tudor times. Yeah, pretty dangerous occupation. Okay, enough of that. And on to a legend. No idea if it's true, but the legend says, at the very same hour that baby Betty was born, John Dudley's missus had a boy, Robert, who'll be in the story. Yeah, it's not true. It's not really true. It's a legend. Robert will have impeccable manners and be a bit of a play actor with the ladies. He's good looking, so will do well in the chicky babe department. Let's move baby Betty along. She can be 2 years old now and betrothed to a Frenchie. Does she care? Not likely, nor do we. More exciting is heads off. Yeah, more heads off. Sir St. Tom Moore, in fact, and St. John Fisher. And baby Betty has a brother when she's two, and oh no, hang on, the baby was dead. And there goes baby Betty's mum off to a stitch-up of a trial and head off, and baby Betty's a bastard. And just to make sure, it'll be an act of Parliament to declare that Lady formerly Princess Baby is incapable of succeeding to the big chair. Okay, that's a nice start to life. Lady Brian will write to Cromwell. Now so it is, my Lady Elizabeth is put from that degree she was afore, and what degree she is at now I know not by hearsay. Therefore I know not how to order her, nor myself, nor none of hers that I have the rule of, that is, her women and her grooms. Yeah, so Lady Brian saying I don't know what the fuck's going on, and then she'll ask for all sorts of stuff for Betty. Now, speaking of Lady Brian, that's just reminded me about Sir Francis Brian, Vicar from Hell. And right now on the podcast, I mean right now where we are, baby Betty's just become Queen. He's in Ireland. He's the Lord Justice there. And he's about to just drop dead. He's 60, so that's not bad. 60's pretty good for the time. And there goes our Hellraiser, spy, assassin, and big banger of babes. And one of Henry's dangerous moves, well, not dangerous for weak, common, smelly types, but dangerous for the royal family, was the fucking about using Parliament to set down the succession. It may be something to do with that whole clusterfuck that we call the War of the Roses, but he's moving from a hereditary to an elective idea about who should have the silly hat. Anybody now in the broader royal family with talent and money could turn into a rival. Yeah, the primogeniture thing, it's just getting a bit of a tickle up. Not a good idea. It will get its victims. Tom Howard, half-brother to Tom Howard. Yeah, you know which Tom Howard I'm talking about. He got life in the slammer. It wasn't really that much about dating Margaret Douglas, but more about having a go at the getting the silly hat. Whether that was his plan or he was just hot for Margaret, we'll never know, but Henry certainly thought that was what it was all about. That then will cause Henry to have that dickhead legislation that he has to prove anybody dating a royal family member. And really, you know, there's a lot of them about. If we start looking at Ancestry.com, most of the nobility can find a king or a queen or a cousin of a king or something like that in their Ancestry.com file. But here comes baby Ted, Prince of Wales, and it's all peace, love and littles again. Now, baby Betty will be very fond of Ted and speak of him affectionately for her entire life. Okay, Jane Seymour can die, and the peace, love and levels are out the window. Didn't last long then. Henry is getting worried, mainly about dying and leaving the big chair to a kiddie, with religious tensions going on in the country. So far as Henry is concerned, the big enemy is Regpole, who Henry suspects would stop Prince Ted from inheriting. It comes to a head again in 1538 when Henry smashes up the shrine of Tom Becket, which causes the Pope to excommunicate him again and say, hey, Scotland, you guys now own England. And there go some Poles and Courtney to the block. This is the atmosphere then that baby Betty grew up in. Suspicion, paranoia, judicial killings. In comes Anacles, out goes Cromwell. Was baby Betty happy to see the end of the guy who had orchestrated her mother's death, I wonder? Out goes Anne of Cleves, in comes Catherine Howard. She's Betty's second cousin, and she'll be gone soon after with baby Betty's auntie, Lady Rochford Chamberlain. In comes Catherine Parr. Oh, thank goodness, she'll put on a good attempt at mothering Henry's three kiddies, and at least the three kiddies will manage to spend some time together. Betty in particular will have a nice relationship with Catherine Parr that we know doesn't end well with Tom Seymour's hands down her knickers. Henry, meantime, is trying hard for that marriage between Kitty Ted and baby Mary, Queen of Scots. If that could happen, then who gives a fuck about what the Pope thinks about giving England to Scotland? Henry can now make England broke again with his stupid foreign war in France. His descendants will be broke. You may recall that Henry's stupid foreign war was tied up with a treaty with Chuck. Chuck included Lady formerly Princess Mary being restored to legitimate as part of the deal. And Henry, for some reason, tossed Fiddy into that bit of legislation, making both bills back to legit and back to princesses. Also part of that treaty was that Betty was now engaged to be married to Phil, her future brother-in-law. Yeah. Henry died and Betty was sent to live with a stepmum, Catherine Parr, and perhaps Catherine Parr's lecherous man, Tom Seymour. Why am I saying perhaps lecherous? Yeah, he's playing with teenage girls' bums. He's lecherous. We then get that age-old story of young girl having to work out how to fend off the wandering hand of Uncle Tommy the stepdad. Catherine Parr then found Tom and Betty in some sort of embrace, and Betty was out, leaving our poor Lady Jane Grey at home with Tom Seymour. 14-year-old Betty will cop a break when Tom, through his own actions, will be done on treason. I say Betty copped a break because it looks pretty clear that by then she'd done that thing, fall in love with Tom, who would have been a terrible choice as a man for her. Fiddy herself had been implicated in all this, and that was a bit dangerous for her. Perhaps that's why we hear bugger all about it during the reign of King Ted VI. Any male that may sniff around her might be immediately suspected of making a move to become king, given that Fiddy is number two on the silly hat list after Sister Mary. She seems to be learning the benefit of keeping a low profile. We do, though, have writings about how well she is doing in the learning department. By the time she's 16, she's going so well in some subjects that she's being compared to a man. Think of that, lady listeners. One of your mob is smart as a man. She's also multilingual, elegant, gracious, wears simple clothing rather than the blingy stuff, has long hair and plaits, and has been compared with philosophers. Girl philosophers, but still philosophers. She's reading the old Greek and Latin authors, and I'm happy to tell you that Cicero is on that reading list. Happy to tell you because he's got some pretty darn smart and good things to say for a future ruler. Very smart stuff if you're ever planning to run the place. She's also reading the Reformation stuff and is a critic of bad writing. By bad, I mean poor writing or lazy arguments. Now, Betty is not the only girl receiving what we might call a higher education. Sir St. Tom either kicked this off or was an early adopter, but Ted Seymour is also having his girls educated, and they're noted as being as smart as Betty is, and Lady Jane Grey, and William Cecil Smith's Mildred. Other writings will tell us that Betty is wearing plain and elegant frocks as a matter of choice. Now, King Ted is sending her fancy stuff and bling jewels, but Betty's just not into it at the moment. She certainly will be into it later in life, but she won't make a start in being blingy until Mary starts running the show and insisting that Betty does do the bling thing. So the bling thing will kick in for Betty, but right now it's probably a smart move for her to be plain Jane, keep a low profile. Let's have Betty get to 17, and I'll give you just the start of a letter that she wrote to King Ted. This is in response to his letter to her saying, "Can I have a portrait of you? Like as the rich man that daily gathereth riches to riches, and to one bag of money layeth a great sort till it come to infinite, so methinks your majesty, not being sufficed with so many benefits and gentlemanliness showed to me afore this time, does now increase them in asking and desiring where you may bid and command, requiring a thing not worthy of desiring for itself, but made worthy for your highness' requests. My picture, I mean." Now, I thought I'd pop that in as an example of what we've lost in the art of written communications. These days, Ted would just send an SMS saying, "Send us a selfie, LOL." Now, the letter goes on and the writing is lovely. Still, it's never all champagne and reefers, and we can steam open another letter that indicates Betty came to visit King Ted but was prevented from seeing him. Yes, somebody doesn't like her. Let's check a bit of that letter. Like as a shipman in stormy weather plucks down the sails, tarrying for better wind, so did I, most noble king, in my unfortunate chance of Thursday, pluck down high sails of my joy and comfort, and do trust one day that as troublesome waves have repulsed me backward, so a gentle wind will bring me forward to my haven. Two chief occasions moved me much and grieved me greatly, the one for that I doubted your majesty's health, the other because for all my long tarrying I went without that I came for. Of the first I'm relieved in a part, both that I understand of your health, and also that your majesty's lodging is far from my marquis's chamber. Of my other grief I am not eased, but the best is that whatsoever other folks will suspect, I intend not to fear your grace's goodwill, which, as I know, I never deserved to fate, so I trust will stick by me. For if your grace's advice that I should return, whose will is a commandment, had not been, I would not have made the half of my way to the end of my journey. And thus, as one desirous to hear of your majesty's health, though unfortunate to see it, I shall pray to God to preserve you. From Hatfield, this present Saturday, your majesty's humble sister to commandment, Elizabeth. Lovely writing, but she's actually right in the letter, saying that, yeah, perhaps Ted is unwell, and now he's dead again. Now, John Dudley will visit Betty to let her know that it's now Queen Jane, and to say, how much cash can I give to you to abdicate as princess and heir to the big chair? Now, Betty will actually stand up to Dudley and tell him he needs to talk to Mary first, because Betty has zero claim during Mary's lifetime. Betty will then wisely get a bunch of hard men to escort her out to meet Mary on her way to London. Yeah, Betty picked team winner there. Betty then got off to a good start under Mary. Betty got to hang out a bit after Mary got to London. That old stuff about you are just the bastard daughter of that total bitch Anne Boleyn seems to be forgotten. Betty, along with Anne of Cleves, get to be the co-stars at Mary's silly be hatting. Can the love last? Of course not. Out of the summer comes Edward Courtney after 12 years. He's 26 and he's pretty, so everybody's going to love him for a bit. One of the first problems for Courtney was that he was giving Betty the eye and not Mary. Betty will find her place at court dropped. It's dropped below Margaret Douglas and Francis Brandon. That's a bit low, isn't it? Betty will discreetly move out of court again to keep her head down. Now, Mary will stop thinking about Courtney and start thinking about Paella and Bill. White can get rebelling and we're keeping an eye on Betty. After all, there was talk about White's dad and Betty's mum. Betty, with a low profile, was certainly complying with the requirement to do the old magic show and truly believed a bit of bread without yeast could turn into the real baby Jesus. But we're not sure about her sincerity and all that. Now, spies tell us that White's man, Sir James Croft, had recently visited Betty, and that she may be on the move to a manor in Donnington, which would be nice and close to those Kenty rebels. Letter in for Mary. We greet you well, and whereas certain evil-disposed persons, minding more the satisfaction of their own malicious and seditious minds than their duty of allegiance towards us, have late foully spread divers, lewd and untrue rumours, and by that means and other devilish practices do travail to induce our good and loving subjects to an unnatural rebellion against God, us, and the tranquillity of our realm. We, tendering the surety of your person, which might chance to be in some peril, if any sudden tumult should arise where you now be, or about Donnington, whether, as we understand, you are minded shortly to remove, do therefore think expedient you should put yourself in good readiness, with all convenient speed, to make your repair hither to us, which we pray you fail not to do, assuring you that you may most safely remain here, so shall you be most heartily welcome to us, and of your mind herein we pray you to return answer by this messenger. Yeah, so it's, look, we're on to you, Betty, my girl, and you better get here right now to be safely in my custody. Betty, we'll write back. Sorry, can't, got a runny nose, can't travel. The French ambassador will say Betty is lucky to be sick because it seems that might save Mary from committing the crime of killing her own sister. In goes White to London, then into the Tower, and three riders are dispatched to bring Betty in for a little chat. 10 p.m. and three hard men will burst into Betty's bedroom. You'll be coming with us, missy. Hang on, says Betty. Look here, you'll see I'm fair dinkum. I'm not pulling a sickie, I'm crook as a dog. Oh, you reckon, they say. That's why we bought a litter and two doctors. And sure enough, next morning Betty is off to London. Her ladies and household will be all boo-hoo-hooing. They're pretty sure they won't be seeing Betty ever again. 29 miles to London, but Betty will manage to drag that 29 miles out over 4 days, and well done. That might let Mary cool down a bit, give things a bit of a think. As we get close to London, gentlemen will ride out, and common types will be cheering and waving. It's looking a bit better. It's messed up Mary's plans a bit, so it'll be sort of house arrest while we send in the hard men with the hard questions about Wyatt. Betty will just maintain that line. Look, all this shit's got nothing to do with me. I don't know why you're talking to me. I've got no idea. Who's this fucking Tom Wyatt anyway? After a couple of weeks, it'll be off you go and stay out of mischief. Nice escape, but here's Sir William Lowe, one of Betty's guys who's been arrested for being with Wyatt in the rebellion. He's going to turn state's evidence, and that includes saying Betty knew about the whole rebellion thingy. Betty is brought back to London, and this time will be in the Tower. Oh, dear. And she's coming via the Traitor's Gate. Oh, that's a bad sign. Betty will ask if she can write a letter to Mary, and the Earl of Sussex, big old softy, will say sure. She will end the letter like this. As for the traitor Wyatt, look, maybe he wrote to me, I don't know, but on my faith I never received any letter from him. And as for this alleged copy of my letter to the French king, I pray God confound me eternally if I ever sent him word, message, token, or letter by any means. Yeah, so, it's sure, look, Wyatt might have written to me, but I didn't get any letter from him, and, look, Henry had written to Betty offering asylum in France, and that would have been a totally stupid thing for Betty to accept anyway. That would have cut her out totally from any chance of an English silly hat. Now, that letter, though, to Mary won't do the trick. Betty had hoped it would get a meeting with Mary. At least the orders are to treat Betty well, so there is that. Now, those orders don't extend to others in the Tower, though, and a couple of White's followers will find invitations. Ooh, an invitation. Morning tea with a chief torturer. Ooh, yeah. What does the torturer want to know? Maybe Betty's involvement with the rebellion. Even better, of course, would be if Betty would incriminate herself, so it'd be hard men in for a chat, headed up by Stephen Gardiner. Boo hiss. Admit it, Betty. Sir James Croft wanted you to move to Donnington Castle. Hang on, she says. Let me think. Oh, that's right. Yeah, I do own a place at Donnington. I've never visited it. Not sure if I could even find my way there, even if I did want to visit it, which I don't. I surely can't remember anyone ever suggesting I visit it. In comes Sir James Croft. Okay, Betty, what do you say to that man? Nothing much, nor do I particularly want to talk to anyone in the Tower, thanks. Are you thinking of bringing every prisoner in to talk to me? Because I'm not into chatting to arseholes. If they've offended my sister, then let them chat to you, big brave man. And look, now that I've seen this guy Croft, I do remember that my guys spoke to him. And yeah, look, there was something or other about Donnington, but who gives a fuck if I visit one of my houses? The Earl of Arundel will kneel and say, Your Grace saith true, and certainly we are very sorry that we have troubled you about so vain matter. Our gracious Betty will reply, My lord, you do sift me very narrowly, but I am well assured that you shall not do more to me than God has appointed, and so God forgive you all. Sir James can kneel and say, Sorry about all this shit, but that chief torturer gave me a good tick up until I said something about you, but I'm just as innocent as you are. Time for Wyatt to die, but just before he does, he'll fuck over Betty's enemies by saying she had nothing to do with all this rebellion stuff. Bring on King Ted's good mate, Sir Nicholas Throckmorton, to trial. No defence lawyers, no defence witnesses allowed, thank you. Nick looks pretty fucked. Even if he can get off rebellion charges, they'll surely do him on religion. But then, copping a break, his trial is at a time when Henry's dickhead treason laws, abolished by Ted, have not been put back. That means we have to go back to Ted III's treason laws, which will be helpful. So they actually need to do him on rebellion, and under Ted III's laws, that's going to be a bit of a challenge. Mary at this stage is new to the game, so it hasn't worked out that you just get into fuckery to get a result. So oddly enough, this is going to be a fair trial. Fuck, a fair trial. Well, not really. If you can't have a lawyer or witnesses, yeah, it's not really fair, but it's fair in that the prosecution will need to prove treason without those laws of Henry that could make anybody guilty. So the jury will acquit Throckmorton, Wahoo, mostly, back to the slammer for him. And as for the jury, it'll be the slammer for them. Yeah, you got the wrong fucking decision, you dickheads. Either these guys will not say we were wrong and will stay in the slammer for a few months and cop a fine. How's that for justice? Lots of these guys, including Throckmorton, will be let out when Phil turns up. Now, Throckmorton have been questioned closely about does Betty love Courtney type of stuff, and will say, look, I can see you guys have brought in a little fish like me because you're wanting to catch a bigger fish, but if you use anything I said to harm great persons, then...
You're a disgrace! Suck my dick and choke on it! Fuck you!
Betty will certainly be taking notes about who is sticking up for her. A couple of merchants out and about will be caught confirming for the mob that, yes, Wyatt had said Betty and Courtney had nothing to do with the rebellion. So those merchants will have their ears nailed to a pillory. Mary's really going after baby Betty. Mary is also looking to send a message to the mob that Betty is still under suspicion. That justifies her being in the slammer. Stephen Gardner-Boo-Hiss will introduce legislation to Parliament saying that Betty is a bastard and can't inherit. Parliament will tell him to fuck off. He'll try another tack. Introduce a bill that says Mary can name a successor just like Henry had done. Oh yeah, say Parliament, yeah, we can see what you're doing there. Mary will want to name Spanish Phil as a successor, say, here's another fuck off for you, Gardner, now fuck off. Parliament are now excited, so it'll be legislation to say Mary is to rule as sole queen with no Phil involvement. Mary will get wind of this and prorogue Parliament to shut down the debate, the cruel tyrant that she is. Now Bojo the Clown did that too, to shut down debate on Brexit. Rupert Murdoch failed to call out Bojo as a cruel tyrant then. Yeah. The anti-baby Betty movement have failed to get her killed or get her locked up for life, but it's still worrying that she's popular. Perhaps some nice long banishment might help people forget about her. Now, Betty's treatment in the tower has been getting, what can I say, maybe uncomfortable might be the word. Ladies removed and replaced by Mary's ladies, no leaving the room, no contact with anyone other than the guards and Mary's ladies, and she must do the old magic show every day. It's a build-up of pressure designed to get some sort of confession. In comes Sir Henry Bedingfield with 100 hard men. Betty will hear a rumour that they're here for her, to take her to an unknown destination. Betty will call in the constable of the tower, and he'll say, yeah, look, sorry, Betty, but yeah, they're here for you. And I think you might be off to Woodstock.
By the time we got to Woodstock, we were 500,000 strong, and everywhere there was song and a celebration.
Yes, Joni Mitchell there, letting us know how marvellous Woodstock was. And she goes on to sing about the atomic structure of human beings and hopes that bombers will turn into butterflies. Not so far. Still bombs dropping in the world every single day. Now, Betty will be saying, hey, tell me more about this Bedingfield guy. Is he the sort you might hire, say, if you wanted to murder a princess out on a lonely road? Make it look like a horsey accident type of thing? Actually, nobody's ever heard of him, so just trust God, Betty. God's come through time and again, not that we can remember any examples of that. Our thoughts and prayers, though, are with Betty at this time. Finally then, after 3 months in the lockup, she goes off with Bedingfield, who will make her feel not better by being just a bit cunty. Harsh and insolent is what the records say. Not cunty, harsh and insolent. Betty's been brought to Richmond Palace, but is still being treated like a prisoner. She is now in the care of Lord Williams, who at least has been nice to her. Betty will tell her gentleman usher that she's sure she's going to be murdered this very night. The gentleman will go to Lord Williams and ask him if that's the case, because if it is, we'll be ready to fight to the death. Williams will say, oh, God forbid that any such wicked purpose should be wrought, and rather than it should be so, I with my men are ready to die to feet also. Ah, we all love Betty. So there's Betty hanging out, and then in comes a message. You can be free immediately if you just agree to marry the Duke of Savoy. Now, Betty's been in a bad place, even though this is now a nice slammer. It's still a slammer with no visitors allowed. She's been cut off from the world, and you may expect that she'll say yes and get an easy get-out-of-jail-free card. But no, marriage to anybody at this stage would mean giving up any hope of the English silly hat. A girlie would need to be single to get that, so it's going to be a no from Betty. That will bring on an immediate move to Oxfordshire, getting further and further away from the seat of power. She will send a cryptic, well, not really that cryptic, message to her faithful servants, like sheep to slaughter. She's still thinking about being murdered then. Betty will once again slow the travel down. She wants to take the temperature of the mob, see if they like her, and they do. It's that Beddington again who's transporting her, and he will be calling people traitors and rebels, but it doesn't stop them ringing the bells. Beddingfield will have the bell ringers put in the stocks. Betty will get to the house of Lord Williams, who's still being kind and has organised a gathering of local dignitaries to welcome her. Beddingfield is outraged and will have his hard men on guard. Beddingfield will send word to London and word comes back. Move her to Woodstock. No visitors. Keep her under guard. It's not as bad as the Tower, but all this tension is taking its toll, so in come the doctors. They'll report back to Mary and include stuff like, she's well behaved and has dutiful humility of sentiments towards Your Majesty. Betty's friends will send messages saying, look, confess whatever Mary wants, then make up with her. That'll be a no. We get this story from the time where Betty heard a milkmaid singing. Betty will say, oh, I wish I was a milkmaid because a milkmaid has a better and happier life than me. Isn't that sad, poor old princess? Speaking of sad princesses, there was a thing in the paper the other day. We've allowed all these fucking tennis players to come into Australia, and some of them got COVID, so thanks very much, authorities, for doing that. But we did put them into lockdown. And one of them, Bernard Tomic's girlfriend, Vanessa Sierra, has had to wash her own hair. This is the worst part of quarantine. I don't wash my own hair. I've never washed my own hair. It's just not something that I do. I normally have hairdressers that do it twice a week for me. This is the situation we're dealing with. I can't wait to get out of quarantine just so I can get my hair done. Oh, that is so sad, is it not, ladies and gentlemen? So, so sad. Beddingfield is trying to keep communication locked down, but he can't. Betty's got servants, and servants get visitors from London, and word gets out. She is keeping up to date on the fallout of the White Rebellion. Betty also has a fan club of Protestant types who keep on sending her messages. Her enemy-in-chief will be Stephen Gardiner Voorhees. Here's some writings from a guy, Sir John Harrington. Lastly, the plots he laid to entrap the Lady Elizabeth and his terrible hard usage of all her followers, I cannot yet scarce think with charity, nor write of with patience. My father, for only carrying a letter to the Lady Elizabeth and professing to wish her well, he kept in the Tower for 12 months and made him spend £1,000 before he could be free of that trouble. My mother that then served Lady Elizabeth, he caused to be sequestered from her as a heretic, insomuch that her own father dare not take her into his house, but she was glad to sojourn with one Mr. Topcliffe. So, as I may say in some sort, this bishop persecuted me before I was born. Yeah, Sir John's dad, who was in the slammer, sent a poem to Gardiner Voorhees. At least withdraw your cruelty or force the time to work your will. It's too much extremity to keep me pent in prison still. free from all fault, void of all cause, without all right, against all laws. How can you do more cruel spite than proffer wrong and promise right? Nor can accuse, nor will acquit. It's actually quite a long poem, but that gives us a flavour of the poem and an example of what's going on with the Bitty fan club. Yeah, Gardner's getting up them all. Mary, meantime, is all, oh, I can't wait to meet Phil and get some spicy Spanish sausage into me. And the English are liking the idea less and less, but there, on the 27th of July, 1554, she and Spanish Philip married in Winchester by Stephen Gardner Boohis. Then they come to London, and one of the decorations was a picture of old Henry holding a magic book inscribed Verbum Dei, or the Word of God. Gardner is horrified. Oh! And say, paint out that magic book. Make it a pair of gloves. At this stage, though, Mary's only wound back King Ted's stuff. We're back to Henry VIII's stuff. So, actually, that magic book should have been okay. But not for Gardner. Phil now being in and married to Mary means we can get Reg Powell in and start that marvellous Make the Pope Great Again and the Burning People can get started. On the other hand, Phil now being here means we're going to have a prisoner release. As you do when some top royal turns up, you have a prisoner release. Nicholas Throckmorton is out, Robert Dudley's out, and others are out, and our own dear baby Betty is out of the slumber. Now, Phil's protection of Betty at this time might be viewed like this. So far as Phil's concerned, if Mary were to die, say, in childbirth, and that's reasonable bet, then it would be Mary, Queen of Scots, inheriting England, making France way more powerful, and that's against Phil's interests. So best if he become friendly to Betty with a view to supporting her against Mary, Queen of Scots. If that is his plan, though, it may not work. Betty is still kind of under house arrest. But it's at her house, at least, with her people and her friends. But if she wants to go anywhere, it will be under escort from Mary's hard men who will stick to her. Betty would also know that Mary will have spies everywhere, including in her own household. So it's not free and easy. Phil is also pushing for that marriage with the Duke of Savoy, and hey, here he is in England, with Phil, right now. So, hey, Betty, come to Christmas lunch and meet this lad. It looks like Spanish Phil was pushing for Betty's release to pick up opinion poll points with the English as well, and Betty was only released to house arrest once Mary was sure that she was up the spout. Even then, it will be a slow sort of reversal process. First to Hampton Court for 2 weeks lock up in a bedroom. After 2 weeks, she's allowed visitors. First will be William Howard, one of old Tom Howard's lads. Then Stephen Gardner Boohis. And who asked to see this turd? Gardner will be back on to confess your crimes to Mary and ask for mercy. Oh, do fuck off, Gardner. I've done nothing, so no need to ask for mercy. If you've got any legal charges, lay them. Now go and tell that to Mary. Next day he's back saying, you better sing a different song, missy. Mary says that if you're innocent, then that would make her wrong for putting you in the slumber. And she's the queen, and so she can't be wrong. So it must be you who are wrong, so confess. Yeah, gotcha this time, missy. Yeah, no, says Betty, I didn't do nothing. Okay, says Gardner, I shall be sure to lock the door on my way out. About a week later, and Betty will score a meeting with Mary. It's all, I'm a true and faithful subject, and don't believe what you read in the failing New York Times. It's fake news. Hang on there, Betty. You must be guilty. Otherwise, I wouldn't lock you up. Betty will be saying, well, look, that's none of my business. My business is to do your will and to be locked up if you want me to be locked up and to never complain about it, ever. And by the way, can you please send me some of those fabulous Catholic writings so I can confirm that I'm doing the religion right and help to wash that filthy reform stuff right out of my hair? Yeah, it may be going a bit far there, Betty. But it's okay, off you go, home for some nice house arrest, and take my man Sir Tom Pope with you. Kind of, it'll be several more houses in London under house arrest still before she can go home. At least there are no doors locked and she's mistress of her own household. And Sir Tom Pope will turn out to be a decent digger and the two will become friendly. Now, he'd made his start working for Tom Cromwell on the dissolution of the monasteries. And you might think that would make him one of Mary's enemies, but no, his reputation is that he just did a fair day's work for Cromwell and wasn't harsh to the monks or anybody else. And on top of that, he's using the cash he made from the dissolution to found Trinity College in Oxford. What a guy. Anne Boleyn would have liked this guy. Yeah, sadly, though, it's going to be a little bit problematic because he's hanging out with Betty and he's going to use that to get jobs with Betty for his Protestant friends. Two gentlemen from Mary will arrive to take away Betty's favourite employee, Mrs. Ashley, along with three of Betty's maids. They're off to the Tower. September 1555, and it's goodbye from Phil after the whole Mary isn't up the spout thing. Betty, though, is back to being heir to the big chair. Mary is now getting baby Betty in regularly to get her to do the various magic show stuff. She wants to see how sincere Betty is, or rather isn't. Yeah, that Kenny Copeland certainly is sincere in his magic stuff, and we should all send him more money. Well, you go first. But for Betty, it's hooray, hooray, Gardner's dead. May his maggot-ridden corpse rot in hell. For Betty, though, this has got to be a time of tension and anxiety. She'll be back into the keeping of the low profile and taking solace in studying the Greek and Latin classics. Learning generally in England's been going to the dogs. Under King Ted, the infighting of the courtiers and their constant making themselves richer meant education was starved of cash. On top of that, a lot of our books formerly held at monasteries have gone overseas. Then we got Mary, and lots of our top intellectuals were gone overseas to escape her bonfires, leaving the dickwit believers in magic back in charge. And under their rule, who needs to read the classics or learn anything? Everything you need to know is in the big book of magic. So you can't suppress everything and everyone, so welcome Thomas Sackville, young guy. His dad, Richard, was a cousin to Anne Boleyn, and despite that, he is part of Mary's council. Tom's done some book learning and is a lawyer. Tom had been to both Cambridge and Oxford and was distinguished at both. He was noted for the excellence in his compositions of both poetry and prose. He's about to be elected to Parliament, but his heart really is in literature, not politics. He will be writing Gorboduc, our very first English tragedy. Will also be the first drama to use blank verse. Now, blank verse is where, instead of using rhyming words, like roses red, violets blue, Donald's a loser, and so are you. Yeah, that wasn't very nice of me, was it? You're not a loser, my dear listener. Donald is. But instead of using rhyming words, you use the rhythm of the lines. So you might have something like da-da-da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, rhyming lines. This thing is a political drama, and that's a bit risky, political dramas at this time. It's about two lads squabbling over the succession of a silly hat and big chair. Yeah, it was one of those things where Dad had decided to divide the kingdom between the two boys to see if that would go well. It never will. This play will go nowhere, though, under Mary's rule. Don't worry, Betty's coming, and it can shine. He will also be working on a piece for the Mirror for Magistrates. Now, that's a bit of a collection by various authors. Now, Tom's piece in that will be a big hit. It's a piece where he meets a chick called Sorrow. Aww. She's a visitor from hell and called Sorrow because she has endless torments, poor love. They have a chat and she says, hey, why not come to my place? So our poet pops on down to hell to check things out for us. Come, come, quoth she, and see what I shall show. Come hear the plaining and the bitter bail of worthy men by fortune's overthrow. Come thou and see them ruling all in a row. They were but shades that erst in mine thou rolled. Come, come with me, thine eyes shall then behold. Yeah, well, if some hot chick asks you to come 5 times, then yeah, you're going to be off with her. Of course you will. Off he goes to meet sorrow's mates, remorse, conscience, dread, and so on. And who should he meet down there but Henry Duke of Buckingham, the old one that Dick III killed, not the young one that Henry VIII killed. Then goes on, but that's enough of a taster for us. This, though, is setting up the scene for guys like Will I Am Shakespeare. Now, that thing also won't be published under Mary. We don't like that sort of stuff under the magic rule, but once Betty's in, off we go. Now, back to Betty and, well, Mary. One of Mary's tactics in the Make the Pope Great Again campaign was churchy bling, particularly at the various religious festivals. Mary was also spending up big on churchy guys' frocks and having marvellous stuff like the statue of baby Jesus dying in agony brought out of the churches and carried through the streets. Then after all that, back to court for mass and parties. Oddly enough, the sight of all that bling will not make people long for the good old days of fat rich bishops and cash splashed on toys for the church. Let's get our poor old Betty back into trouble. One Dudley Ashton, mate of our dead Tom Wyatt in France with other exiles, is looking to stir up shit for Mary with Frenchy backing. He will send a condemned man, Cleobury, who will pretend to be Ted Courtney to raise the men of Devon. To help out, Ashton will have printed material that says Courtney is either married or engaged to be married to Betty, and that they should be king and queen. Betty, though, will be okay. Mary and the council think that this is just typical Murdoch press shit at work, so won't believe it, and will even send message to the Pope saying, tell Betty it's all good. Mary will follow up with a personal letter, and Betty will reply. And among the three things, I chiefly wish this one, that there were as good surgeons for making anatomies of hearts that might show my thoughts to your majesty, as there are expert physicians of the bodies able to express the inward griefs of the maladies to the patient. For then I doubt not, but know well, that whatsoever others should suggest by malice, yet your majesty should be sure by knowledge, so that the more such misty clouds obfuscate the clear light of my truth, the more my tried thoughts should glitter in the dimming of their hidden malice. And so on. She really is good at writing, isn't she, Betty? November 1556, and Betty will move to Somerset Palace, her town residence of magnificent, built by Ted Seymour. It's the Christmas season, but it's London, so the courtiers will be heading in. We're all excited for the Christmas parties. Off she goes to court, and we'll get another proposal for the hand of the Duke of Savoy. Now, Phil's been pressing the council to get this done. It will be a no, and Betty is going to go home to Hatfield. No Christmas parties for Betty, because she's been a bad girl. She said no to the Duke of Savoy. Phil will write to Mary, order Betty to marry the Duke of Savoy. But oddly enough, Mary will also say no. I know you're shitty, Phil, I could tell from your letter, but no means no. Phil will send the Duchess of Parma and Lorraine with instructions to bring Betty to Flanders. Mary will have a Plantagenet rage. Good on you, Mary. And tear Phil's portrait. Oh, ooh. Mary is now jealous and angry. She sees the Duchess of Lorraine as Phil's floozy, and fair enough, that's what a spy's told her. Mary will tell those duchesses that Hatfield is off limits to them, and they can just fuck off out of England, so fuck off they do. Now, this seems to bond of the two sisters, with Betty coming to London in February 1557, and then Mary will go to visit Betty at Hatfield. Oh, isn't that nice? And it will be the magic shows and the bear baiting and the holy plays at night. Then Summer and Betty's invited back to London to see a play with Mary. She will get to go by the royal barge from Somerset House to Mary's garden, where we have a pavilion of magnificence. It will all be feast of magnificence, then plays and minstrels, and we're having a lovely time, the two girls together. Here comes the Swedish ambassador with another proposal from Prince Eric of Sweden. Prince Eric had wanted to turn up personally, but his dad wisely pointed out that in that case, Betty may well notice that, yeah, Eric's insane, and say no. Betty will say no in any case, because you should have asked Mary and the council first. Ambassador will say, okay, I'll go and ask Mary and the council. Betty will say, don't waste your time, because it'll be a no from me anyway. Now, Prince Eric just so you know, will eventually become king. He'll be deposed, he'll be tossed in the slammer and murdered, as you do with insane kings. Sir Tom Pope will write a very detailed account of this back to Mary. Now that will be about it now for business between Mary and Betty. Really then, for about the last 3 years of Mary's life, Betty's life was pretty good. Mary by now though is back to head of the English Church. Parliament had insisted on that, and so she is busy rooting out the filthy Protestants for a good burning. But having stripped England of its cash to send to Phil for his stupid foreign wars, and having lost Calais, and having burnt some good people, and sent lots of our best and brightest into exile, on the 17th of November 1558, aged 44, Mary can fuck off to heaven. And the mob will go crazy. We've been liberated from the Spanish tyranny, and there's a good chance we'll be given the Catholic crap the boot again, and hopefully our bonfires will stop having humans in them screaming in agony. And Catholics aren't happy. But Ridgepole's also died, and it's to be our brave and beautiful princess who has suffered, the poor love, and now she will get what she richly deserves. She was a lady of great beauty, of decent stature, and of excellent shape. In her youth she was adorned with more than usual maiden modesty. Her skin was pure white, her hair the colour of yellow, her eyes were beautiful and lively. In short, her whole body was well made, and her face was adorned with a wonderful and sweet beauty and majesty. House of Lords and House of Commons will get the news that Mary is dead. What have they got to say? God save Queen Elizabeth. Long and happy may she reign. Bit of Andre Antunes there, knocking out some Antonio Vivaldi, Four Seasons, Winter. Brilliant stuff, isn't it? Lovely. Vivaldi will be born about 100 years for us in the podcast. Well, that'd be good. We'll be able to bang lots of Vivaldi on. No historical fiction for you this week, my dear listener, because there's something else on my mind that I'd just like to share with you. Just as politicians can't lie, because it's true when they say it, governments can't do bad things, because they're good. All our governments are good. They only do good things. Because all our governments can only do good things, they get rather annoyed if some snotty individual comes along and says they've done something wrong. How dare that individual try and say that? And just because they've got shit-like evidence, it's just appalling, my dear listener. Sometimes, though, it sadly turns out to be true and inescapable that the government is responsible for something that's wrong. Case in point, Australian Army lawyer David McBride uncovered war crimes committed by Australians in Afghanistan. Tried to do the normal thing that you would do, go through the proper channels and so on, but the government just didn't want to hear about it, and so he did that extremely brave thing, turned into a whistleblower. I say extremely brave because things never go well for whistleblowers, never ever do they go well for whistleblowers. But there you go. The crime is out there. We all know about it. And so the government has leapt into action and is prosecuting David McBride, of course. Not prosecuting the criminals? No, fuck that. We'll go for the whistleblower. So the point of this little rant is to recommend to you change.org, where you can sign a petition to see if you can help this bloke David McBride out. Totally futile, in my opinion, because governments just fucking hate whistleblowers. Hate them. So David McBride's chances are pretty grim, but you might feel a little bit better yourself. So change.org and find David McBride and off you go. But for us, it's a matter of what we go out with. It's summer where I am in space-time, and summertime I sometimes fancy a bit of bluegrass. So how about we go out with the Olive Bell Reed song, High on a Mountain, performed by a mob I think they call themselves Hot Rise. They're Americans. You know, Americans like to spell things differently. Hope you see you next week. Bye.
worried about the days I used to be. As I looked in that valley down below,